Hello and welcome to Terrifying Robot Dog. I'm Jonathan Stark.
And I'm Kelly Shaver.
And we're here to talk about how technology is changing the way we interact with the world. This week, we're bored. Please stay tuned. Terrifying Robot Dog is next.
So bored.
Nothing excites us anymore.
No. I don't know if it's me or if it's the things. I suspect it's me.
I have a theory on this.
Okay.
And it's a hazy theory, but you and I kind of operate at the application layer. Like, that's our history.
Mm-hmm.
My background in tech came, you know, first, of course, video games. And then when I started programming, it was in BASIC. And the very first thing I wanted to do, you know, like, it seemed like everybody did, was create little ASCII, animated ASCII art.
Right.
And it had this visual component that, you know, fast forward a couple of years, I was still into computers, doing light programming, script kiddie stuff, Apple script, things like that. And then I got into FileMaker, which I still wouldn't 100% qualify. It has a lot of aspects of programming. It's kind of like macro programming, very drag and drop. And it's a great entry point because things can get very complicated with function recursion. And there's a pretty robust script editor. It's not free text, but it gets there. It starts to look like a real application. Then I went into web, but I had an Access database period in there somewhere, SQL. I had a job doing SQL. So we're sort of like from the era of people who build applications on top of relational databases.
That's true. We very much are.
Yeah. Right. So that's not where stuff's really happened. I just feel like there are exciting things happening, but not for people who build interfaces on top of relational database systems.
Yeah.
You know, the web comes along at a certain point. You start to get NoSQL databases. You start to get distributed databases. You start to get, I don't know, what else happened on the web? Decentralized peer-to-peer programming. I mean, some really, really non-relational database type stuff. And by and large, you and I didn't really get into any of that.
No, I mean, we dabbled in it for a while, and I think both of us concluded that, I'm going back to relational databases.
Yeah, everything I need to do can be done with a relational database. And like this, this new stuff, we kind of didn't see the use case for it. So here's the thing. Okay, so this is all leading up to an article from Benedict Evans, who I really think is often on the money about stuff. He works at Andreessen Horowitz. I think he calls himself an analyst or something, but he basically has a lot of contact with majorly funded startups who are still in their early phases and are playing around with stuff, that is, you know, things like Lyft and Airbnb and, you know, the sort of new style. And lots of AR, VR, Magic Leap, I think, is one of their investments, and a lot of machine learning companies.
Mm-hmm.
And so here's the thing. And he wrote this article recently called Ways to Think About Machine Learning. And he, much to my surprise and delight, he compared machine learning and all of this sort of bad, like, silly press and FUD and, you know, about robots taking over the world and all of this stuff. He's like, machine learning is not really like that. It's more like relational databases were in the 70s. And I was like, oh, okay. Now I'm listening.
Okay. That's piqued my interest.
Yeah. And he talks about it in a way that I tend to agree with, which is that it's becoming machine learning is, you know, still in relatively early stages, but it seems clear that it's the next big thing and that it's going to be an enabling layer for a bunch of other stuff. So, you know, and then he draws the parallel. He talks about databases. He's, you know, before relational databases and before you had like a structured query language, if you wanted to go to your database, which was essentially a pile of records that were like, they were structured, but they weren't related. So it was kind of like it would be like gigantic Excel spreadsheets, or I think EDM, that's electronic dance music. What was the, there was a fixed width data format that was super popular.
Oh yeah, I don't remember, but
yeah, in the 60s, yeah. It was kind of like space delimited, like, oh, okay, we've got 12 spaces in each column, so you can put up to 12 characters.
Right.
And if you only have 5 characters, then there'll be 7 blanks. And then, so you never knew what size your delimiter was. And
yeah.
And, you know, EF COD comes along and sets up basically his rules for normalized database design, and relational databases come around. And Evans, his contention is that once that happened, it changed databases into business intelligence systems. So if you wanted to run a query before relational, if you wanted to run a query for, you know, show me all the customers that bought this product and who also live in this city, you'd have to pay a team of engineers to start a programming project.
Yeah, or pay someone to sit there and manually just look through the records.
True.
Whichever was cheaper.
Whichever was cheaper and faster, yeah. Whichever you wanted.
Yeah.
But that became like, and think about that situation right back then. Both of us came after this period. Relational databases were already a thing when we came on the scene. So
yeah, it's like when you were talking about before relational databases, and I'm thinking, wait, there were databases before there were relational databases? What were they?
Yeah, flat files.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
so
can you even call it a database?
Right. Yeah. Like, what is the point of a database that's not relational? Like, we can't even imagine the purpose. It's pointless almost. You know, so you're like, what could you possibly do? So that comes along, but nobody had the use cases yet, or very few people did. And so imagine the effect it would have on all those engineers who used to manually write code, probably in, I don't know, C?
Assembly or, yeah.
Yeah, maybe, right, maybe lower, that would go through, or COBOL. I don't know anything about COBOL except for it's old. But they would go through like a gigantic flat file or something similar.
And just parse it out.
And just parse it. Like, you know, like this would be pre-Perl, but it kind of sounds like the thing you'd do with Perl. Instead, and awk, probably all those things had their roots in that, I'm guessing, but that their roots were sort of from that period. So now somebody comes along and says, you know what? This is ridiculous. These are obvious questions. You can see an obvious use case for wanting to know how many people in New York bought this widget. Like, duh.
Yeah.
Like, why wouldn't you want, you know, you, of course you'd want to know that. So let's come up with a query language that allows the business people or someone closer to the business people to answer these questions that people have in a way that doesn't take 6 weeks. So SQL comes along and think of the effect that that would have on the people who were writing the queries before. Like, no, any idiot can write. You know, and SQL is not exactly user friendly.
Right. But, I mean, it's not horrible, but there's definitely, yeah. I mean, it definitely takes a little bit to get your head around.
Absolutely. But it doesn't have the same feel as writing code.
No.
It's definitely different than that.
You can get into some conditional logic and a little bit of formulas and stuff like that, but it's not. Yeah, I mean, well, it's a query language. It's not, you know, you're not writing executable code.
Right. And there's stored procedures. There's all sorts of things that you can do and functions and blah, blah, blah. But by and large, you're doing joins across tables to get answers to business questions. And so, okay, so he's like, all right, a couple points about that he believes are going to be parallel in machine learning. And I tend to agree. The first is that it allowed you to ask... it allowed you to get better answers to the questions you were already asking. So you could, you know, better meaning more quickly and more accurately.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're like, wait a second. If I can get an answer to this gigantic low-hanging fruit question, how many customers bought this widget in New York City, in the cost of asking that question went from $100,000 to $10 or $100, what other questions could I ask? Since it's cheap to ask a question now, what other questions can I ask? So you start asking new questions. And, I don't know. I just thought, I thought this was super fascinating. And, there's a third one too. I didn't write it down. But so the point is that once people start asking, new use cases. Yeah. New use cases start showing up. So that's the third one. And he was like, relational databases created billion-dollar companies like Oracle. which then enabled companies like SAP and others in that their sort of ilk, their colleagues, which then enabled like global just-in-time supply chains, which then enabled companies like Apple or Starbucks to even exist.
Yeah.
So before, like Starbucks couldn't exist without relational databases, is his point, which is just wild.
Yeah, that is. That's crazy to think about. But I can definitely see where he's coming from, because without that, without the ability to like manage and collect and query and analyze all of that data, then you can't do things like you said, the shipping and the efficiency in the supply chain and that sort of thing. Yeah. Yep. So it does.
Yeah, it makes sense. Like syncing all of these systems, mm-hmm. like, you know, thousands of different systems that may or may not be from the same vendor, you know, across all of your suppliers, and doing it quickly enough and cheaply and enough.
Affordably enough, yeah.
Mm-hmm, that you can sell, you know, a $5 cup of coffee and still make a profit.
Right.
It sounds ridiculous.
It does, because that's a lot for a cup of coffee.
That's a lot for coffee, yeah.
Yeah, I can make a cup of coffee for about 3 cents, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you have to get up. You have to
push the button.
You have to wash the pot after. It doesn't have that logo on it. So, okay. So now think about machine learning. And if you imagine, dear listener, that it's going to go through a similar cycle, and I believe it will. It seems to be.
It seems logical. Yeah.
Yeah. That we're creating a new enabling layer that will first give us better, more reliable answers to questions that we're already asking. So we can get the answer faster and more accurately. So better answers. But these are the questions we're already asking. But then we're like, wow, if we can get answers to those questions,
what else can we ask?
What else can we ask? Exactly.
Yeah. Is this all just circling back around to the fact that the point you're trying to make is that we're just old, stubborn programmers now?
No, not yes and no. Yes and no. I think the exciting stuff is I think we're no longer the exciting people. Like, yeah, we were in the space that was exciting for the longest time.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
And I've definitely felt that. And part of it may just be that I've been doing it for a long time, but I've definitely felt the excitement over what I'm doing, even when I'm doing new things, is not at all what it used to be, because it's just like, well, that's kind of fun because I've never done it before, but still it's just, you know, this thing, it's really nothing amazing. And maybe that's just because I've been doing this for a couple of decades now, but
yeah, I think it's a combination.
It feels like the technology is kind of shifting away from the stuff I'm doing, and it's led to kind of some general dissatisfaction with what I am doing, mildly, but coupled with a lack of desire to move beyond it, because I just see so many practical uses for it still.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's just one of those things. It's the adoption curve. You know, we're at that sort of Gartner hype cycle plateau, mm-hmm. of productivity, I think it's called, where it's like, you can still do tons of awesome stuff with this. You know, like, remember when Rails first came out? Mm-hmm. Like, that was exciting. Like, to like talk about nerd cred. That, I mean, I never got into Rails, but it was really exciting. I was like, oh man, like that demo that DHH did was like, whoops, it worked. That demo.
Yeah.
It was like, man, all of a sudden that might have been right around the same time where I got sick of coding so much by hand, like at such a low level, which is comical to even say, because the low level I was programming at was PHP. So,
right.
You know, somebody in the audience who is like a C programmer would be like, clown, you know, you didn't even have to allocate memory.
Amateur.
Right. I was an amateur, but that was the cool thing. Like, so PHP came along and like clowns could program now.
Yeah.
If you want to,
yeah, it was a blessing and a curse.
Yeah. And the reputation of the language suffered under that exact mm-hmm. context, or that culture around PHP was a bunch of clowns could suddenly make web pages that did stuff. They were interactive. They could talk to a database. And it was like, yeah. Oh man. And like, so like a bunch of garbage code came.
Like it didn't matter if your code was bad.
Yeah, it worked.
You could still make it do stuff. Yeah.
Right. So cool. It was so cool. And there were so many business cases for it at the time. And just so many of these problems, like it just feels like a bunch of things have happened. First, we've been doing mm-hmm. it for a really long time. So, you know, mm-hmm. only 15 years for me, but still, you know, and then it, there's less excitement around it because duh, of course you can do that. Just use Rails, right? You know, it's like the proliferation of gems and libraries and frameworks and Stack Overflow and Google. I mean, Google wasn't around. Like, Google didn't do anything when I was learning how to code. There was, it existed, I think.
Mm-hmm.
When did Google, I don't know when Google started. I think it was in the late 90s, but it wasn't useful. Like, Yahoo was still king back then, and that wasn't that useful right. either because the web yeah. wasn't that big comparatively.
It's like I remember one time during a Rails Rumble, Stack Overflow went down and just like everyone was panicking.
Postponed rain date. Rails Rumble right. rain day. So, okay. So what is this? So this is kind of, it's kind of cool. I think this is cool. I think it's a natural course of things. But the thing that I liked the best about this was looking at machine learning less as like our AI overlords coming to get us and more like, what happened with relational database systems and how that, mm-hmm. what that enabled. So when, if you think about machine learning, it's like, okay, a bunch of questions that we're already asking, like indexing is a big thing. So a classic, common, typical, normal use case, or what am I trying to say? Current use case would be to, like, let's say, ESPN or ABC Sports, they want to index all of the interviews that they've ever done, you know, their on-camera personalities mm-hmm. have ever done with sports people. Like there's probably sportsters or whatever they're called. And
athletes, I think is the word.
Yeah. So they probably, I'm guaranteed they have all of the clips in some kind of database, if they don't call me. And they.
And those databases have foreign keys.
Right. Yeah. But I guarantee you they don't have full transcripts for everything. I guarantee that there's some mm-hmm. crappy, incomplete metadata around each one because humans are humans and it's all, and this is the thing, it's all manually entered, guaranteed. And over the course of years and your 10 years, a decade of manual data entry around like, you know, this person interviewed that person from this team. And like, think of all the queries you could do if you had, if you ran machine learning on, you know, run database on photos, you know, run machine learning on these photos or sorry, these videos. And now your structured query language becomes normal human questions like that mm-hmm. you would just say out loud.
Yeah. And the machine learning algorithms and what have you can go in and analyze and look at those video clips themselves mm-hmm. and extract all of the missing metadata that your intern with a migraine didn't enter one day or, and get other data and draw other conclusions and see patterns and things from it that you, like a human entering that data would never have even thought of.
Yeah. It's funny you say that because later in the article, Evans says machine learning is kind of like having an infinite number of interns. So, you know, if you had 1 million interns, what could you do with them?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could say something like, show me all the funny interviews that reporter A did with someone on the Celtics. Just like that. Like that's the sequel. Select all from, you know, and boom, here you go. It's like crazy, but it makes sense. So like these are, so that's the kind of question that no one's asking, or, you know, somebody at ABC Sports isn't asking right now because there's right. no
the data's just not there.
It's not there. Right. And if you can do it in real time, you don't even have, it goes beyond business intelligence. And this isn't in the article, but it's just occurring to me. It goes beyond business intelligence systems and it's straight to the consumer. So instead of the executives at a company deciding what reports they want to run or what statistics they want to see on their dashboard, they just be like, you know what? You do it. The executives can say to their customers directly can go to ESPN.com
and find whatever you want
and just say to the microphone, show me all the funny interviews with Mike Tyson. Boom, done. Show
yeah, you. The company doesn't have to decide what data to expose or what how to categorize it or how to present it.
Right, because they have infinite interns and they just get it for you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, what? It makes sense though, right? Like that doesn't seem far-fetched at all now.
No, it doesn't.
And that's just indexing video. And it's not, I wouldn't even call it indexing. I don't think that's the right word for it. And you can imagine it getting even more abstract, like show me interesting videos with the implied that I will find interesting. Show me interesting videos with Mike Tyson.
Right.
Mike Tyson was a sports guy in the 80s, in case people don't know who that is. Is he famous still? I don't know.
I don't know, but it's weird to think that we may have listeners that are that young.
Unlikely.
Yeah, probably so. Yeah. Yeah, this is us.
Well, so here's what's cool about this, I think. So if we, there's a bunch of layers to look at it from. So you could say, okay, like I'm no longer in a place in my life where I'm interested in the nuts and bolts of machine learning and like mm-hmm. getting in there and like installing TensorFlow. I can't even get Rails installed. So it's like installing
TensorFlow. I wrote a really nice guide for that.
I know. I heard. I know. I should try it again.
It's gotten quite a bit easier over the years.
Yes, but I've gotten worse. So
it evens out.
Yeah. I'll look at that. I have an idea. I have a project in mind, but what I'd really rather do is just like, you can just see like, okay, to go back to the engineers who used to take 6 weeks to parse a gigantic flat file.
Yeah.
Now there's a whole swath of certainly, it's probably already happened to people who write SQL queries for a living, but people who build graphical user interfaces on top of database systems, this is not good for that group because there's going to be a whole new way to interact with data that takes out all of that interface in the middle where, I mean, we do this all every day where we have to make a bunch of decisions about what people are going to want to do and then give them the controls so they can do it in a way that we guess is going to make sense to them and we guess is going to serve the use cases that they have in mind.
Yeah, that's like 90% of our job.
Yeah, right? So let's just say instead of all that, we've got infinite interns.
Right, like it's a big the entire user interface is replaced with a big microphone button.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, more or less. Yeah, take the photos off of my hard drive and do X, Y, and Z with them. And you can even abstract it farther. Increase the number of leads to my website.
Right.
Or whatever contact thing. Increase the number of emails that I get. You know, like how abstract mm-hmm. do you want? Get more money in my bank account. Right. You can keep
pay
backing
off all my
up.
Debt.
Right. You can keep backing up.
Yeah.
You know, infinite interns can do a lot of stuff.
Handle all of my adult responsibilities.
Right. I mean, imagine trying to build that with Rails. You can't. But you can imagine the Google Assistant going in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
Like Rails is never going to get there, but Google Assistant might. It's comically, you know.
We've
like,
abstracted it out to a comically large level.
Yeah, yeah. But that's the concept. You know, make my kids love me. Right?
Bring meaning and fulfillment to my life.
Enjoy my vacation for me.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Listen to all the music and tell me what I liked. Oh, man. But okay, so here's the thing. I think I know that there's tons of excitement around that space. It's constantly in the press. It's like mainstream press, never mind tech press. So there's all of that excitement around it. There are a bunch of people who are like us 20 years ago who are down in the trenches getting really excited about like the superpowers that they are now available to them and to a certain extent they are creating. So that's really cool. That feels very been there and done that to me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really, that's not the vibe that I'm looking for anymore, but keeping an eye on where it can be applied, you know, like where the enabling layer is for stuff we have or care about or are working on. That's pretty interesting. And like what kinds of questions, thinking about what questions are we already asking that could be answered better, even if we're just sort of sprinkling machine learning around on Rails apps, let's say, mm-hmm. or, you know, some side projects or charity thing or whatever we're working on. Then it's like, okay, once that's there, what questions should we be asking now that we have this new capability? And then what use cases will get built on top of it? Like that piece, like I'm just, it's a combination of like getting older and less interested in like I just don't want to, first of all, I don't want to build a car from scratch anymore. And I don't even want to repair a car anymore, but I do, you know, perhaps be interested in driving somewhere in the car.
So, or I'd rather have the car drive me somewhere.
Well, that's true. But the transportation aspect of it, it just doesn't interest me anymore to like change the oil.
Yeah.
So, which at one time that was how does this thing work? This thing that gives me freedom, how does it work? How do I keep it working? You know, especially when it was a $500 junker that often didn't work. So, and I had no money to get someone else to fix it.
Right.
And I do not want to imply that I'm handy. I could just about handle replacing fluids and that's it. But so anyway, the idea, I feel like for me anyway, or maybe people of our generation, or, you know, we're almost the same generation. The new use case is the place where it starts to get exciting, where you, the kind of the, I don't want to say code monkeys, cause it's not code anymore really, but like, you know, the people who are 15, maybe 18 that are just really, really loving this and, you know, doing robotics in high school and being exposed to this stuff at a very low level. That's cool for them. Like let them do it. And I'm more interested in the business opportunities that come on top of it. Where like keeping an eye peeled for like, what are the new questions?
What is this going to let me do? Asking?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, yeah, I'm getting to the age where I just want stuff to work. Right. Like I don't care how it works. I just want it to work.
Right.
And looking around at the new possibilities this opens up to me, it's just as exciting. It's just a different, just operating at a different region of the activity, I guess, in the sort of machine learning space.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that, being the age where you want things to just work. I was just thinking the new Fire TV that you were talking about an episode or two ago. It's like, it appeals to me so much because I'm at the point now where I still have not bothered to figure out how to use the PlayStation 4. And sometimes I like to watch TV in the living room. So every time I do, I'm like, hey, Richard, how does this work?
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm a software developer. I should be able to figure this out, but I haven't cared enough to learn yet.
We had a family wedding on Saturday and I went to my dad's house after everybody was meeting after it was like 10 in the morning. And then we went to my dad's house for a barbecue and I had Maggie with me and she tapped out at the reception. So I was like, I'm going to go to your house early and you guys can just meet us there. So it was just me and Maggie at the house. And she's like, I want to watch Paw Patrol. I'm not exaggerating. It took me a half an hour to figure out how to get the TV to turn on and go to
Proper input.
And it was, so I turn on the TV and YouTube is right there. It's like one of the icons. They have this big smart TV and it's right there. Half an hour. It took me to figure out how to navigate to that icon. And
half an hour with a tired toddler.
With a tired toddler. Thank you. Yes. So I was just like, really? Like I should just be able to say, you know, a name, play Paw Patrol. Like just do it. How hard could it be?
Right. I know you know how to do this.
Yeah. So yeah, it's wild. And but on a similar sort of angle, I got this Pixel 2 phone a couple of weeks ago and I was afraid it was going to be hard to switch off my iPhone. So I didn't port my number over. I didn't swap a SIM card or anything like that. So I used it for like a week or two using the built-in Project Fi for my cellular service, which is, it's like an over the top thing. It's like a service built on top of Sprint and T-Mobile where it has a soft SIM and it gives you a Fi phone number, which then magically kind of like roams between the two networks, whichever one's better, wherever you are. But the billing model is like a dream and the website is like a dream. There's not a ton of stuff on it. There's just exactly what you're looking for. There's live chat with people if you need help. I go there and like the billing model is something like it's $20 a month and $10 per gigabyte or something like that.
Yeah.
And you can't pay more than $60 a month. So your maximum bill any month is going to be $60. Minimum bill is something like 20 or 30. That's it. That's like the whole thing. And so I used the phone for a couple of weeks and I'm like, you know what? I totally made the transition. I backed up my old iPhone. I got all of the stuff like you know, Coinbase and Authenticator and stuff that you don't automatically have a cloud version of. Mm-hmm. I got all those things off there. I double checked, triple checked, made sure all my photos were off and all that stuff. And then I went on the Project Fi website. There's an app on the phone, Project Fi, and just ported my number over, my old phone number, to the new phone. It was like the easiest thing in the world compared to, and this won't be meaningful to people who haven't tried to do something on the AT&T website.
Oh, God.
But if you ever try to do something on the AT&T website, it's like the whole thing was designed to make you call them. It is so bad. And apologies to anybody who works on that project. I know it's not your fault. I know it's just an expression of the corporate behemoth, you know, designed by committee. It's just one of those things. But when you look at the user experience of like Project Fi compared to AT&T, it's comical. There's no comparison. Project Fi is way better. And maybe this will blow up in my face at some point, but it's so much better. No contract, nothing.
Yeah.
You pay $20 a month, and then at the end of the month, you get a bill for however much data you use. Simple. With a cap at $60. So you can't go broke if you like leave YouTube running in the background. It's like amazing. So, you know, compare this to, you know, compare a new kind of, call it a customer interface or call it a user interaction model or a customer interaction model of something like that compared to an AT&T. And you look at, you know, this, I mean, there's at least 75 remote buttons on these remotes I was trying to use to control my father's TV.
And you multiple remotes. Yes.
There are three remotes. Yeah. And none of the same brand. None of them match the brand of the TV. You know, it's like, which one? I'm just pressing. Like, start at the top left and press a button and see what happens.
Right.
And you compare that to Fire TV, and you're just like, Alexa, play Paw Patrol. And boom, it's on. Turns the TV on. Switches to the right channel. Launches it. It just does what you want. And that, I mean, it's all machine learning. I mean, right? The natural language processing, the Fi business model thing, who knows what's going on back there switching between cell towers, who knows? But that's the kind of experience that seems like where we're going. And it seems like machine learning is the enabling layer for that, or will be those kinds of experiences. And this menu driven, button driven, Byzantine sort of like hierarchy of controls. I mean, it's certainly there are some things that probably will always have to be done that way, but maybe those things become things that we get less interested in doing over time because they're so cumbersome, and just start doing new things that we can just, you know, instead of a structured query language, unstructured query language, UnSQL, not NoSQL.
Not NoSQL, UnSQL.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. You'll get your dinner out of the fridge and throw it in the microwave, and the microwave will just come on and know how to heat it and, you know, like know what you're cooking and when it's hot. And
I can picture this. We've been using Instacart and Uber Eats and all those mm-hmm. things, and it already does this. It already will send you a strangely well-timed text message. Hey, do you want another order from push notification?
Mm-hmm.
Hey, how's pizza sound? Because it knows that we ordered Pizza Gourmet, I don't know, at the same time or in the same place, or when we were in the same place at this time last week, we did it.
Yeah.
Or so, it's doing something because I'm like, oh, that's a pretty good idea. Like right at the right time. And I'm like, pretty soon you can imagine there being a checkbox, just make this a regular
thing. Yeah.
Friday night pizza from whatever, Pizza Gourmet. Like, okay, yeah, that's fine. And you just come home. Like, we'll send the order. As soon as we detect that you've entered your house, we'll start cooking.
It's like, right.
Never mind the microwave.
Like, oh, we noticed you're home. Here's dinner.
Right, exactly. And yeah, Wally, don't tweet Wally at me.
No, because there's such a large chunk of my life that if I wasn't spending it on maintenance things that I had to do, I would be out doing things that make me more physically active.
Yeah, and more fun, like more fun, expressive, yeah. And you
like
know,
I'd be going to the lake more, and I'd be like, you know, hiking, and it's just all kinds of stuff that.
Yeah.
You know, go play more games.
Right, like the conceit of Wally that I disagree with is that given sort of unlimited free time that everyone would just sit in motorized chairs and drink soda. That's, I mean, will people do that? Yeah, a lot of people would do that. But those are people that are probably doing that now.
Yeah, I mean, it's true that, yeah, you know, obesity rates in the U.S. are climbing at alarming levels and things like that. But I don't think that improving the technology is going to make it worse. I don't think that's the cause. Or if it is, I don't think it's the cause in the same way that people are thinking that it is, that it's making us lazy. I think it's that there's so many things that we have to keep up with and do that consume our time that we don't. You know, we don't have time for the time or energy to get out and like, oh, I'm going to go to the gym and work out, or I'm going to go for a long walk, or that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Because we've spent so much time on all of this other stuff that if we didn't have to do that.
You know what's causing the obesity epidemic? Relational databases.
That send you push notifications, or is it machine learning that says, hey, do you want pizza?
Exactly. Well, speaking of which, I have to go to the gym now. So let's wrap up.
Alrighty, sounds good.
All right, folks, that's it for this week. I'm Jonathan Stark.
I'm Kelly Shaver.
And we hope you join us again next time for Terrifying Robot Dog. Bye.
Bye.